like to just go ahead with the Dharma talk now, since I don't know how long it takes. Time for some questions at the end. I do would like to reflect on the theme of contentment and to talk about how contentment is really used in this teaching and tradition. 2600 years ago, somewhat exhausted by years of struggle and striving and resistance and seeking for enlightenment, the young and somewhat disheartened and disappointed Siddhartha found himself recalling a time when he was a young boy, and a time when he just was sitting on a hillside overlooking his father's land and watching a farmer plowing his field. And he remembered how there had arisen in him a very unexpected and unsought for, but a very powerful and sublime sense of contentment. And he recalled in that moment how there had been no thought of there being anything missing, no thought of going anywhere, no thought of getting anything. And it was a moment that he remembered as a time of a very profound ease and joy and stillness. It was his first glimpse of contentment. Now that memory was, for Siddhartha, a very powerful turning point in his own journey and his own quest for liberation. Because that memory of contentment really encouraged him to reflect on the difference, what the difference is between aspiration and striving. It called upon him to examine some of the very powerful urges that had driven him in his life to always look outside of himself, to always look to the future for happiness and for peace and for freedom. And the memory made Siddhartha question whether the freedom and the happiness he sought for, whether it was going to be born of something that he gained, or whether it was going to be born of what he could let go of. Now, throughout this teaching, contentment as a quality and as a cultivation is emphasized and repeated time and time again. If you look on the teachings of kindness, of metta, you see how, and generosity, you see how much contentment is emphasized as a thread that runs through them. If you look at the teachings on generosity and on joy, how much they build upon a sense of contentment. And certainly when the Buddha describes that the liberated heart, when he describes freedom, he very much speaks about this quality. And I'd like to draw a little bit in the talk this afternoon upon some of the early poetry from the Chan tradition. And one of these poems really speaks about contentment. It says, "The entire day I searched for spring, but spring I could not find. In my straw sandals I tramped among the mountain peak clouds. Home again, smiling, I finger a sprig of fragrant plum blossom. Spring was right here on these branches in all of its glory." So I would encourage you to reflect on any, whether you can remember any moment in your own life where you have encountered a very deep sense of contentment. It's not always a great dramatic moment. Sometimes it's just getting up in the morning and being able to step outside and to be touched by the loveliness of all that you see. When you have felt able to relax into a quality of stillness. And I think if we can remember any moment of contentment in our life, we're very aware of those moments, how there's a cooling of all the waves of agitation that can be so much part of our lives, about going somewhere, about becoming someone, about getting something, or getting rid of something. And the very nature of contentment is really the heart's unbinding from that agitation. The capacity to be present in the presence of all things. The calming of any sense of insufficiency or lack. Now, if you can remember any moment of contentment in your own life, I think it is a good question to ask about what do those moments teach us about the nature of happiness and unhappiness, about the nature of sufficiency and the sense of insufficiency. The Buddha certainly spoke about contentment as the greatest of all blessings. The Dalai Lama, in speaking about it, he once said, if one cultivates simplicity, contentment comes. Simplicity is extremely important for happiness. Having few desires, feeling satisfied with what you have is very vital. Satisfaction with just enough food, clothing, and shelter to protect you. And finally, there is intense delight in abandoning faulty states of mind and cultivating helpful ones. Now, I think sometimes we hear the word contentment, and if you think about it, you know, what kind of associations do you have with that word? And sometimes we hear the word contentment and what might come into our mind of, you know, our images of cows or sheep, you know, grazing in a field, you know, kind of mindlessly going from one mouthful of grass to another. But as a doorway to freedom of heart, the quality of contentment that is really spoken of course, is not a bovine contentment, nor is it a prescription for resignation or surrender of aspiration. Instead, contentment is really spoken of as something that is very vital, very alive, very much a beginning of a life of freedom, of a liberated heart. And I'd like to just give you a little bit of a, because I think it's important, a little bit of a historical context for this teaching on contentment. You should think about it 2,600 years ago, when the early monks and nuns went to join the Buddha in a homeless life. And, you know, remembering that India 2,600 years ago, of course, was extremely poor country. And yet people would give up whatever they had in terms of security or status or safety in order to join the Buddha in a homeless life, which is really a life where they could rely upon nothing, where there was no certainties, where, you know, every mouthful of food relied upon what was given to them in that day. It was, you know, in many ways an extremely unprotected life, and I imagine would take a tremendous amount of courage to undertake that. But when people came to join the Buddha, the ability to rest in a contented heart meditate or rest in contentment was very much a key to determining whether that life of uncertainty was going to be a life of peace or whether it was going to be a life of desolation and deprivation. Now, of course, this is just as true for monks and nuns today as it was then. Now, in those early days, the first instructions that those monks and nuns were given were the teaching on the four great contentments. So the Buddha would say, encourage people, be content with any robe you are given, whether it is lovely or shabby, or even if you're not given a robe at all. And here, too, the Buddha would really caution against poverty conceit, knowing the ingenuity of the human mind. And he would say, you know, just because you've got some shabby, holy old robe, you know, don't think it makes you a better monk or nun than Joe or Sally down the road, you know, who's got a really good robe. He would say, be content with any food you are given, whether it's a gourmet meal or scraps from someone's table, or even if you're given no food at all. He would say, be content with any lodging you are given, any bed you are given, or even if you are given no lodging at all. And again, the Buddha would caution against conceit, you know, not using our own contentment or simplicity to judge others. And the fourth great contentment was to take delight in the happiness that is born of letting go and developing an unbounded heart. Now, clearly what the Buddha was really pointing to in this teaching on contentment was a kind of attitude, an inner attitude, in relationship to all things. So contentment, as he spoke about it, was not about endurance, you know, or finding nobility in deprivation. He wasn't speaking about the contentment as a cultivation of misery, but actually as a cultivation of joy. Now, of course, we might say, well, okay, this is a fine teaching for monks and nuns, you know, but what about us as lay people? What does it mean for us? And I think what it means for us is the kind of attitude we have in relationship to all things. Because what the Buddha was talking about, he wasn't talking about what we have and what we don't. What he was talking about was no longer agreeing to the world of conditions, whether it's food, clothing, status, or experience, as being the gatekeeper of our happiness and freedom. Now, I think if we think of any single moment where we find ourselves wrestling with the world of conditions, it could be the weather. You know, it's too cold, it's too hot, it's too wet, it's too dry, you know. It could be our neighbor, you know, who disturbs or doesn't disturb us. We can argue even with our meditation cushion, can't we? It's too hard, it's too soft, it's too low, it's too high. I need this, I can't bear this, I must have this, I must get rid of this. If you can think of any moment, and we probably have lots of them, where we're arguing with the world of conditions, probably you notice how instantly unhappy we are. How instantly we're placing ourselves into a state of distress, and what we are experiencing in those moments is the suffering of discontent. The suffering of discontent. At times we start to realize that none of the conditions in the world ever had the power to project us into this discontent, but that it is a power that is given to and handed to the world of changing and uncertain and unpredictable conditions. Now, central to the teaching of the Four Great Contentments, it very much draws on what I was speaking about this morning, that it is a very simple statement that the sources of joy and the sources of sorrow live within our own hearts. That the source of contentment and the source of discontent equally lives within our own heart. Now, Kabir had something to say to this. Some of you might be familiar to this. I said to this wanting creature inside me, "What is this river you want to cross?" "There are no travelers on the river road and no road. Do you see anything moving on the bank or resting? There is no ground, no sky, no time, no bank, no ford. Do you believe there is some place that will make the soul less thirsty? In that great absence you will find nothing. Be strong then and enter into your own body. There you have a solid place for your feet. Think about it carefully. Don't go off somewhere else." Kabir says this: "Just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things and stand firm in that which you are." Now, this understanding, I think, this question, whether the world of conditions truly holds the power to dictate our happiness or unhappiness. The questioning of that is, I think, is the beginning of contentment. Because when we experience those moments of discontent, not enough, it is a little bit like a heavenly messenger waving to us from the crowd. Every moment we sort of feel the surges of distress, of "I don't want this, I need this, I have to get rid of this, I must have this." It's like those surges have written upon them a reminder and an invitation to pause for a moment, just to be still for a moment, and to be aware of where we are delivering calmness and peace and sufficiency of our own hearts into the hands of conditions. Conditions that very often we simply cannot control, but that we can make peace with. A contentment, in my understanding, is not so much, I think, a particular feeling or a particular state, but the contentment has something much more to do with what we are choosing to do with our attention. Because have you noticed how easy it is to feed discontent? You know, perhaps you have a little rub against the world, you know, that, you know, it rains rather than it is sunny, you know. Or, you know, a friend suddenly doesn't return your call. You know, have you noticed how easy it is to feed discontent? You know, to fan the fires of discontent with endless sort of dwelling and feeding thoughts and imagining and speculating or insisting that the world be a certain way. But we can also feed contentment. Contentment is also something we can nurture, where we can learn what it means to question that delivery of our well-being, to know how to stop, to know how to return to just this moment, to calm the waves of distress, and to cultivate contentment. Sometimes it is really not so complicated. David White, he wrote a small poem called Enough. He said, "Enough. These few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here. This opening to the life we have refused again and again until now. Until now. I think contentment is sometimes really an awareness of the refusal. The refusal to make room for this, for this, for this, just as it is. But 2,600 years ago, you know, there's a long history to discontent. It's as long as human psyche. You know, and 2,600 years ago, in looking at his own mind, in looking at the minds around him, the Buddha saw in himself how much the force of craving was one of just very few forces that seemed to hold the power to dispossess us of freedom and to dispossess us of contentment. That he identified this force of craving as being one of the few forces that seemed to have the power to cause this immense and optional struggle and sorrow and sorrow. He likened craving to a thief that takes up residence in our hearts, and that the mission of craving is to convince us of insufficiency. To convince us of an inner insufficiency, that we do not have enough, are not enough. And in very real way, when we're caught in the power of craving, it seems to have the power to blind us to the capacity to see the peace and the freedom in each moment. But rather sends us into the world, to prowl the world, to roam through the world, looking for what we believe is not available to us from within. Now, the Buddha had a lot to say about craving and the way it consumes, the way it consumes that sense of inner freedom. But he provided this roadmap of craving, which I think most of us can probably follow and probably relate to in our own minds and hearts and lives. And I find it a very useful roadmap for unpacking those moments of discontent. So he talked about the craving for sensual pleasure, the craving to become or for becoming, and the craving for non-becoming. What about these three threads? So let's just look at the first, of sensual pleasure, the craving of sensual pleasure. Let's see these as two different things. You know, that there is sensual pleasure, and then something else is the craving for sensual pleasure. Now, for sure, for all of us, we experience in our lives countless lovely, lovely moments each day. You know, the sounds of the birds, you know, the clouds moving in the sky, the beautiful picture, at times even the loveliness of our own thoughts. You know, people we take great delight in, emotions that can be quite lovely, of kindness and generosity. And it is deeply important in this practice to be able to appreciate and delight in the lovely. Because it gladdens our minds. They gladden our hearts. You know, the lovely often brings a sense of spaciousness, a sense of connectedness. And I find, you know, there's too much of a tendency, I think, in Western practitioners to feel deeply suspicious of the lovely. You know, that if we appreciate it too much, we're bound to fall into craving and grasping and delusion. It is so important not to feel afraid of the lovely, as if it's somehow a more noble or virtuous practice. If we spend every moment grappling with suffering and, chipping away at the coal face of delusion, it doesn't make it a more virtuous practice. Now, the lovely is part of the fabric of all experience, and in many ways, I think we get a real taste of contentment in the lovely, in our capacity to appreciate the lovely. Have you ever had those experiences, looking at a delightful painting, or listening to a wonderful piece of music, or being with a friend that you really appreciate? And you notice in the loveliness of those moments, the mind is not longing and prowling, isn't it? Is it? There's that sense of ease, of completeness, of resting within that love. And the pleasant, sensual pleasure has never been an obstacle or a problem. Yet something else often creeps into it, doesn't it? I want more. This lovely outside, I think, it's even better from the top of the hill. That meal was great. I'm going to have the second plate. That I had a few thoughts about a friend I really enjoy. Oh, let me have a wonderful fantasy. Keep this one going. How something else creeps in and almost distorts that sense of sufficiency. So some years ago, every year I teach at a center in Switzerland, it's high up in the Alps, and you look outside of the windows of the meditation room, and it's just this alpine range in front of you high up. It's actually one of the most gorgeous places to practice in the world. It's every moment, it's a sense of this just this awe and delight. I remember once a few years ago talking with a student on retreat there. They were marveling, just how amazing it was and how beautiful it was. And then they came back. They said, I'm coming back. This is the best place to practice in the world. And they came back on the retreat the next year. And she said to me, this isn't as beautiful as I remember it. and I had the thought, I know there's impermanence and things change, but I'm pretty sure the Alps haven't radically changed in the space of a year. But it was somehow trying to fix that loveliness as something to hold on to that distorted the capacity almost to see it anew and to find that same sense of awe and marvel and celebration, because it had almost become a sort of possession of the mind. And then reality somehow didn't match up. We even see sometimes how we try to employ craving as a way of getting rid of suffering. And the Buddha was very explicit in saying this endless prowling, this kind of mechanism of insufficiency was the cause of suffering in our lives. But sometimes when we don't see that, we even try to use craving as a way to get rid of suffering. If we can feel discontented in ourselves, we think, I'll just fix it. From the TV, from a friend, open the fridge. I'll just fix it by using some more craving. All we're doing in those moments is actually compounding suffering by trying to use craving to get rid of suffering. When we see the craving for the sensual pleasure, which is very different than the appreciation of sensual pleasure, I think what we're really trying to do is and the subtext of that, is trying to create a world where we are surrounded only by the pleasant, never intruded by the unpleasant. And the subtext of that is the belief that I can only be happy when conditions are pleasant. That I can only be peaceful in the presence of pleasant conditions. And of course, that endeavor, which is not an unusual endeavor in our world, to create a world where we have only pleasant conditions and avoid unpleasant ones. Of course, when we look at that realistically, we see it's absolutely doomed to failure. I mean, none of us actually has that power, do we, to control conditions in that way. We see it's doomed to failure. So in some ways, we hang our freedom, or pin our freedom and our happiness, not only the world of conditions, but our ability to control conditions. And then we feel, you know, that somehow I'm a failure or not good enough, but, or, you know, because I haven't been successful at manipulating conditions in my world to have only pleasant ones. So it is the craving for sensual pleasure that is the cause of suffering, and not the sensual pleasure itself. Now, contentment, I think, in those moments of wrestling with the world of conditions can often seem to be very, very far away. But I think it's important to question whether that is actually true. Whether contentment is actually something far closer to us than we actually appreciate. That contentment might be that willingness just to step out of that fire of endlessly trying to mold conditions to our taste and to our craving. That contentment might actually be that moment of stepping out of the restlessness, out of the prowling, being able to breathe out and to cool the fires. To cool the fires of craving. There's another short poem from the Chan tradition. It's a spring morning on the lake, the wind merges with the rain. Worldly matters are like flowers that fall only to bloom again. I retire to contemplate behind closed doors, a place of true joy. While the floating clouds come and go, the whole day long. Now the second form of craving that the Buddha talks about is very much the craving to become. Craving to become someone, to become a person who has a certain kind of description and portfolio. Now, I'm sure that we can all remember times in our childhood where we had all kinds of fantasies about who we wanted to become in this life. Successful person, or this admired person, or, you know, this popular person, or this very much loved person, you know, all of the kind of ideals that we entertained about what we wanted to become. Now, many of those fantasies, of course, may just be at this point a distant memory. I think what we don't always see in the craving to become is how disconnected we can be with who and how we are. And this seems to be almost a kind of existential discontent. And remember, contentment is not about the surrender of aspiration or possibility. It's not the surrender of aspiration or possibility. Contentment is about the surrendering of discontent. How there can be this sort of existential discontent of just not feeling good enough. Not feeling to be enough. And how that existential discontent launches us into this craving to become, the craving to divorce ourselves from that feeling of not good enough, which is so painful. What we don't see that in this craving, you know, to become something else, to be, even to become happier, to become more enlightened, you know, to become more successful, even in those more subtle cravings, what we don't always see about is how that is a movement of rejection and abandonment of what, of how we are. It's not only a movement away from the experience of how we are, but in that abandonment of how we are and the craving to become, it's also a movement away from acceptance and kindness and contentment. And again, it's so easy to use craving as a kind of solution for what we can't be at peace with. I mean, I see this in meditation all the time, particularly with people who practiced a bit more, you know. The frustrated meditator is a very sorry sight. The frustrated meditator, I'm an experienced meditator, you know. I shouldn't be falling asleep. You know, I shouldn't be restless. You know, I shouldn't be envying my neighbor's meditation experience, you know. I shouldn't be sort of sitting here fantasizing about being the next Buddha, you know. I'm an experienced meditator. This shouldn't be happening for me. It's the craving, it's really seeing how that kind of, then I'm going to fix it, you know, I'm going to fix it. I'm going to be the best meditator. You know, I'm going to be the meditator who's always awake, you know, who always has the right answer. I'm going to be the best yogi. I want to be perfect. I want to be perfect in that bottom line. I want to be perfect. I want to be perfect in everything I do. Because actually that's the only way that I'm going to sort of be happy, be content, is if I've actually earned it. You know, this sense of earning contentment through the pursuit of perfection. And that pursuit of perfection, quite frankly, it can be subtle, it can be gross, it can run through all of our experience, can't it? Whether I'm going to be the perfect meditator, the perfect mother, the perfect partner, the perfect parent, you know, the perfect anything. How much that drives us, that craving to become, and how much that craving to become is constantly fanning the fires of discontent. And how often, really, is it successful? And that is a great disappointment, because somehow that ideal of perfection very rarely seems to be reached. The reverse side of that, and actually these two are very tied in together, you know, because the craving to become is very much tied in to the craving for non-becoming, the craving for non-existence, because the craving to become is automatically a reaching to get rid of something else, isn't it? To make something else go away. I mean, the extreme of the sense of the craving for non-becoming, of course, is just the annihilation of our life. You know, the ceasing to exist. But this wanting, needing something to go away, it doesn't have a conscience, does it? I mean, have you noticed that listening to a minor cough in a meditation room can be met with exactly the same reaction as some major experience of disappointment or failure? You notice exactly the same reaction. It's the same, it has to go away. Why doesn't it stop? Why doesn't it end? It can almost be, you know, it differs only in degree, doesn't it? You know, the minor cough, well, if they'd stop coughing, I'd be really happy. Oh, the major disaster in my life, you know, I want this to go away, this has to stop. It is this craving for non-becoming, of course, it's a whole movement of aversion. Not being able to bear, the fear of being overwhelmed, the fear of being lost, the fear of being disappointed. It's such a powerful force. Now, I think that when we begin to track the movement of craving in our days, in our minds, in our hearts, that it can actually seem so pernicious and so pervasive that it's almost inconceivable to imagine a life that is not governed by craving. I mean, what would our life look like? What would our minds look like? What would our relationships look like if they were not governed by craving? I mean, on one level, misconstruing that, we would see, well, we have no reason to get up in the morning. You know, we may as well just stay in bed all day, you know, not seek for anything, not cultivate anything. But that's not what's being suggested. What's being suggested is actually to imagine a life that is not governed by craving and aversion. The Buddha speaks about this as nibbana, or liberation, of blowing out those fires. When we hear that, I think it's very important just to see that when the Buddha talked about this, about blowing out the fires of craving, he wasn't necessarily speaking about some huge ultimate breakthrough experience, but as a practice of cultivating contentment. It's actually a practice of cultivating contentment. Where? Well, in the face, in the all those moments of the powerful surges of craving that say, you know, I've got to pursue this, I've got to have this, I've got to get this. What does it mean to cultivate contentment in that moment? To practice the cultivation of contentment in the midst of all those moments of aversion that say, you know, I have to get rid of this, this has to go away, this has to disappear if I'm going to be happy, if I can be at peace. What does it mean to cultivate contentment? What does it mean to cultivate contentment in all those moments when we find ourselves sort of leaning into the future, you know, the better moment, the perfect moment, the more ideal moment? Seeking, or in the moments when we're seeking to become something else or denying what is. What does it mean to cultivate contentment in those moments? To be able to recognize in our lives where we are cultivating paths of unhappiness that lead to further unhappiness. And where we are cultivating paths of contentment that lead to a deeper contentment. The practice of contentment is actually the practice of liberation. Now this is, and I have to keep reiterating this, this is not a sacrifice of aspiration of all the very wholesome, the very skillful longings that we have that are at the heart of our journey and our lives. You know, the longings for intimacy, the longings for happiness, the longings for connectedness. In many ways, these longings are actually not separate from the fabric of contentment. Now, I think that we don't always see craving as craving, but we do easily much more see agitation and restlessness. This is, I think, the much more visible face of craving. When our minds feel so filled, you know, with thoughts and plans, when our, you know, when, have you even noticed here, you know, how you know, you walk down this, you know, we have a very simple day here, but have you noticed how hungry the eyes can be? You know, how we can't pass something pinned on a notice board without stopping to read it as if it's delivering some life-saving message, you know. You know, you see it on retreats, you know, when people stand, you know, awestruck in front of notice boards, you know, reading, you know, recipes, you know, reading instructions on fire extinguishers, you know, reading tea boxes. You know, just that, you know, that restlessness of the mind? Of the, it's not a restlessness, it's a restlessness of the heart. The feeling that it's just not enough. Huh? And I think agitation and restlessness is a much more visible face of craving for us to start to connect with, you know, than some of the kind of quieter voices of craving. I think agitation and restlessness very much expresses itself in impatience. Have you noticed that? You know, like you know, we have plenty of opportunities, don't we, to experience impatience in this life. Frustration. Things don't work on time. You know, things don't arrive on time. Things don't unfold according to our timetables. You know, people don't change according to our timetables of how they should change. You know, events don't unfold in the way we hope them to be. And we feel the restlessness, you know, the judgment, the impatience, the frustration. This is all the visible face of craving and aversion. And it's all the visible face of discontent. So if, you know, because I don't think agitation's hard to spot. I think agitation's easy to spot. So if we're willing to really start to know restlessness and agitation as it is, and just to look beneath that first layer of agitation and ask what the root of that agitation is, what do we see? Usually we see craving, the craving for more, the craving to get rid of, the craving to become. Now, if we look just beneath that layer of craving, what is it that we see? Very often what we see is a notion or a belief in insufficiency. This moment is not enough. I am not enough. Now, if we can find the collectiveness in ourselves to look those surges of craving in the eye, it'll probably become evident to us about how much the anxiety of me, the anxiety of self, is really at the center of all those surges. Now, this sense of insufficiency, I think, of not having enough, not being enough, not being good enough, this is really the belief system of the anxiety of me, isn't it? And it goes right to the heart of the teaching of liberation. Because if the anxiety of me is believed in, the insufficiency of me is left unquestioned, then I think discontent and craving will follow us, just like night follows day. Now this is this relationship between insufficiency, the anxiety of me, and craving and aversion. I think if we look at it closely, we can see that kind of interwoven fabric of that very easily. It's a simple, but it's not an easy truth. But what happens if we don't make our home in agitation? What happens if we don't make our home in agitation? If we don't follow its waves, what happens then is that we're not making our home in craving. What happens if we don't make our home in craving is that we also don't make our home in the belief in insufficiency. This is the teaching of the four great contentments, that the source of joy and the source of sufficiency lives within our own hearts and not within the conditions of the world. The Buddha describes that discovering of inner sufficiency as a heart that is luminous, that is without boundaries, that essentially is the most genuine step into homelessness. Genuinely the most important step into homelessness, where everywhere is home, when it is not obscured by agitation. Now, I think that in an ideal world, we would first discover this unshakable contentment and freedom. And in the light of that discovery, we would lay down or let go of all the agitation and craving, and it would just fall away. Now, perhaps for some very exceptional yogi, it goes in that order. But I think for the rest of us, we're asked to cultivate contentment, to unbind our hearts from the grip of agitation and craving by making a commitment to contentment. By making an inner commitment to contentment. Now, one of the ways, I think another one of the very obvious ways that the belief in insufficiency manifests itself is in doubt, the mental state, the emotion, the experience of doubt, self-doubt, that expands into doubt in the path, doubt in the possibility of genuine transformation, doubt in our capacity, to really make those radical inner shifts. Now, have you noticed what doubt does? That doubt makes us waver, doesn't it? That doubt really weakens intentionality, it sabotages intentionality. That doubt sabotages commitment. Now, I think this operates all through our lives. I mean, for example, we could get up in the morning with the intention of going into our day really mindful, really kind, really present. And then, have you noticed that the moment we meet the first uncooperative person, you know, our uncooperative mind state, we have a much better idea than being really mindful and really present. That intention essentially gets sabotaged. Now what happens when our intention gets sabotaged is that doubt arises. Doubt arises. I can't do it. It's not possible for me. Now doubt makes then our intention weaken again. You know, we waver, you know, I can't possibly ever do it. Doubt is constantly convincing us of insufficiency and incapacity. I can never do this. So it's so interesting to see how doubt and the weakening of intention and the weakening of commitment and then the belief, the fostering of that belief in insufficiency goes round and round and round in a toxic loop. Where does it stop? I think it's a really important question, because doubt can be such a sort of feature of our lives in everything, can't it? In our worthiness, in our lovability, in our relationships, in our work, in our practice. And doubt so sabotages intentionality and commitment. So where does it stop? Not by telling ourselves that doubt should go away. Doubt, I think, is really... You know, and doubt is so, you know, there's no contentment in doubt, is there? There's always a sense of no home anywhere. And the real antidote to doubt is actually commitment, but not grandiose commitment. What happens when actually we commit to just one breath, just one step, just one moment? It is a step into the unfamiliar. How much is that kind of commitment to just one moment really an ally for us? How much when we take that step into committing just to this one moment of being present, are we actually taking a step into the cultivation of contentment? I think that it's so important to see that contentment is not a sort of one-dimensional experience. It has all of these threads of confidence, of inner reliance, of trust, of confidence in our own capacity to be upright, to find joy within our own hearts. Just as also doubt is not one-dimensional. Doubt has all of these threads of insufficiency, of incapacity, of the inability to sustain intentionality. They're almost like coexisting. And in many ways, so much of this practice is really acknowledging that what we feed will grow. If we feed discontent through the pursuit of craving and aversion, discontent will grow. If we feed contentment through being able to question where the source of joy and sufficiency really is, if we feed contentment by learning to stop, learning to pause, learning to commit to just one moment at a time, contentment will equally grow. I'd like to end by reading you a poem by one of the early Buddhist monks. It's kind of a warrior poem. It's actually called No Greater Contentment. It says, when the thundering storm cloud roars out in the mist, and torrents of rain fill the paths of the birds, nestled in a mountain cave, the yogi meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When along the rivers the tumbling flowers bloom, in winding wreaths adorned with verdant color, seated on the bank, glad-minded, The yogi meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When in the depths of night in a lonely forest, the rain davis drizzle and the fang beasts cry, nestled in a mountain cave, the yogi meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When restraining oneself of discursive thoughts, devoid of fear, the yogi meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When one is happy, unobstructed, unencumbered, unassailed, having ended all defilements, the yogi meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. So if we just take a moment quietly, then we've got a little bit of time for any reflections.
Listening to a Dharma talk, it was on Dharma Seed, I think, where you said, letting go of discontent is an act of great generosity to yourself. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah,
vaguely. I loved it. I thought it was wonderful because there was a sense of generosity in that as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, I remember listening to that that talk, and that just stayed in my head because I thought it was so useful, letting go of discontent, and that sense of how we generate it for ourselves. And I was going on a long haul flight, and I remember just sort of bringing that to mind and thinking, because there are a few things I like less than flying, and I just remember keeping that in my head during this whole flight, and many things went wrong, and it was one of the best flights I've ever had, despite missing my connection, all these things, and there was just a sense of keeping that in my mind, and it's never happened again like that. You know, it was sort of one of those moments where I just having that sense of, you know, what I was creating for myself. Really changed my experience. And it was very self-contained. It's not happened again. But I just remember that phrase of sort of letting go of the discontent because it was all stuff that I was generating. And I remember that very well. And it just, listening to you today reminded me of that. And it was one of those experiences that just has stayed with me.
And I think the other part in that, you know, that, and it does kind of really actually have that sort of immediate sense of, you know, liberating yourself from a whole world of suffering. And that, which is why I think it's so important to, you know, because I think very often in practice people have this idea, you know, this kind of shoulding in practice, you know, let go of discontent as a sort of should, a contentment, a commandment, without, you know, easily forgetting that actually it is a gift. You know, that it's a gift of generosity, it's a gift of happiness, you know, and to undertake it, that light, rather than some kind of imperative or, you know, a good yogi, let's go, discontent, you know. Actually, what happens when I let go of discontent in this body? It actually is that opening into something much lovelier.
No, it was amazing. And then the flight was cancelled and it was okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm serious. I'm not making this up.
I had the same experience with the red traffic light. When it was red, changing it to a positive, letting go of the discontent and having to stop and treating it as a moment to rest.
Absolutely. It's so true, isn't it? Because it's really rather extraordinary the ways, you know, I mean, something like that, a red traffic light. I mean, it's not impossible, really, is it, you know, a red traffic light. But how we can give to that event the power to actually devastate our well-being in that moment. Something so impersonal, you know, and how it can also be a reminder of just liberate oneself from this, you know, liberate oneself from the red traffic light. And it is that. So those shifts can be so small, but you know they're also cumulative. You know, it's like the discontent is cumulative. You know, like the more you practice it, the better at it you get. Okay? The more irritable, the more everything becomes personal. The more everything is an imposition, intrusion. You know, the whole world is against me. But contentment as a practice is also cumulative. Mm-hmm. The mind starts to know that landscape. You know, it starts to build landscape. And one of the kind of wonderful things I find about meditation practice is the way that what used to appear normal actually starts to look slightly suspicious. And what used to look slightly suspicious starts to actually appear normal. You know, because I find when many people start to practice meditation and they bump across a moment of calmness, you know, or bump into a moment of stillness, and they're so accustomed to agitation, you know, restlessness, and they had a moment of calmness, and it's like, wow, that was calm, you know, I was calm, you know. It's like this total shock and astonishment, you know, calm, you know. It seemed like it's just this little glimmer in this long kind of landscape of agitation. But actually, the more you practice, the more the heart and mind becomes actually sort of naturalized in calmness, in stillness. Like a moment of agitation is like, wow, a moment of agitation. You know, isn't that curious? What is that all about? And rather than sort of bad news, it's like, what is that all about? And it is a lot about where we're practicing making our home. And one of my favorite sayings of the Buddha, and I repeat it over and over again, that what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. You know, and if we dwell upon discontent, it becomes the shape of our mind. And the shape of our mind very much becomes the shape of our world. And if we dwell upon contentment, it too, with practice, becomes the shape of our mind.
There are many very beautiful words and concepts in the Buddhism that one hears again and again, and talking about contentment and kindness and compassion and patience and wisdom. And there's one that I don't hear very often, and it's gratitude. And I find that when I come into my body and feel calm, one of the first things that happens is I go straight to gratitude. Gratitude for the body, opportunities or wonderful teachers. And I just wondered if you could say something about the relationship between mindfulness or contentment and gratitude.
Yeah, I think gratitude is very strongly highlighted. Buddhist teaching. I mean, certainly, you know, if you look on the more formal sense of when, you know, a monk or a nun is offered a meal, you know, there is a, you know, kind of recitation of gratitude and thankfulness. And it's very much emphasized as part of what we hear in the teaching, a lot is about what we offer, you know, how much we extend kindness, how much we extend generosity, how much we extend, you know, forgiveness, etc. But the other part of the teaching is just as much, it's about how we receive, that from others, from the world, you know, the many ways in which we're touched by tolerance, patience, forgiveness, kindness of others. And that is all part of that fabric of gratitude. It's very much part of metta practice, of loving kindness practice. When loving kindness practice, you know, includes the benefactor, you know, where the benefactor is highlighted in loving kindness practice. That dimension of loving kindness practice is very, very specifically there to remind us of our capacity for thankfulness and gratitude and being able to receive. And it's as much an important part, I think, this path as being able to give. And as you say, it's very easy. Craving and longing. Yeah, I mean, and I think it's very important because I mean, I think you get a sense in this path, you know, how much there's an honoring of longing. You know, the longing for intimacy, the longing for happiness, the longing for peace, the longing for kindness. It's very much part of the fabric of our motivation and inspiration. And I think it is often a very fine line between longing and craving. I don't know if this is helpful, but there's these very different words in Pali that describe this sort of landscape of desire. What the monks call the landscape of desire, because desire is a landscape. You know, which can include the kind of unskillful and the very skillful. You know, there is a word for desire which is just describes a very sort of, you know, very ordinary, you know, I'm thirsty, I'd like a drink of water. You know, that kind of just very ordinary, practical, get through the day kind of desire. You know. There's another level of desire, you know, the word tanha, which is the word for craving, which really means unquenchable craving. And this is the difference between craving and longing. Because tanha, which is the unquenchable thirst, really can never be satisfied. It has no fulfillment. It just goes around, you know, a temporary relief and then a resurgence might be for a different object, but in fact it's the same kind of feeling of insufficiency of enough. So tanha describes this impossibility of being satisfied. Whereas there's another word which is chanda, which describes very much the wholesome longing. The longing for freedom, the longing for connectedness, the longing for peace. And the difference between chanda and tanha is that chanda, or the wholesome, skillful longing, can be satisfied. It can actually be satisfied. It's not unquenchable. they get sort of mixed, they, you know, they seem to get mixed up, and I think that's probably human, you know. I mean, we can have, you know, we can have very wholesome longings, and there can be traces of tanha in there, you know, it's not necessarily completely pure and diluted, but I think we start to discern the difference. You know, because also the very nature of tanha, or the unquenchable, is it's usually just out of reach. You know, it usually takes us away from where we are. You know? When I'm really craving for sensual pleasure, really craving to get something, craving to get rid of something, it's often a kind of leaning forward, you know, when this happens or when this goes away. Because I think the very nature of chanda, the longing, is actually to return us to where we are rather than to take us away.
Do you think some of that longing or agitation that actually comes from something real, which is that there is uncertainty and groundlessness and no home, you know, and that's so that something quite profound, really.
Which is coming from?
Well, agitation or...
I think initially that kind of agitation. You know, agitation, I think, is a reaction to some subliminal, often awareness of groundlessness, of uncertainty, you know, and I think agitation is often a reaction to what we don't want to accommodate, you know. So it's trying... often the endeavor to make certainty where there is no certainty, and to make ground where there is no ground. So it is, I think, as you're saying, often covering up something extremely profound and potentially quite liberating.
But tough to.
If we can align. But what is tough? I mean, that's good. What is tough? Is the uncertainty. Or is the uncertainty actually just the way things are? Is tough our fear of the uncertainty?
It's more the experience of there being no ground, sure, nothing. It's that sort of experience. Difficult one to actually face.
Yes. Also very difficult not to, because doesn't it just keep marching right along into our lives and reminding us? And isn't it also really hard to endeavor to not accommodate that which keeps marching into our lives?
How I'm aware of that constantly, always trying to build something that might fill that space of this.
Yes. And I think it takes somebody, I think we can be really quite reluctant learners about acknowledging how kind of ineffective that is. And how it seems, instead of easing the anxiety, it seems to make us more anxious because we're on some level, we know it doesn't work. But this is where, you know, I think it's a little bit like this was saying, that, you know, this kindness to ourselves in not grasping. You know, that there's a kindness to ourselves in not trying to make certainties where there's uncertainty. No, it's actually a kind of, it's a compassion for ourselves. You know, and I think we really need to change the kind of how we frame that. You know, because so many people spend their lives shouting at themselves to let go rather than to maybe I just actually need to make this adjustment to be aligned with the way things actually are. You know, because it can often feel very discouraging when we're kind of shouting ourselves to let go, as if somehow this is in my realm anyway, I'm just going to let go. But maybe I'm just going to cultivate the conditions that allow the letting go to happen. You know, the seeing of the way things are, the cultivation of the inner calmness, the inner contentment, maybe that's what allows the letting go to happen, rather than me trying to command myself to do something which I cannot do anyway. But there can be that cultivation which allows that alignment and kind of stretch to happen.
Yeah. My mind keeps coming back to this idea of aligning oneself with conditions of which one has no control. On our way up here, some of us drove up together and we were voicing our discontent with boxes and struggling a bit. And as the day has been going on, I've just been thinking, how much time have I been spending like voicing discontent with this condition that I can't change, I can't get rid of my boss, short of changing my job, which I haven't managed to actually do. And so then you were talking about aligning yourself.
Yeah.
How does one really, really practically in the world align oneself in such a way that everything, the relationship becomes easier, the working relationship becomes easier?
But sometimes it's accepting the limits of your power. And sometimes it's accepting the limits of what power you, also the potential of your power. It's both, I think. You know, because you take that situation. I mean, there are so many conditions in our life that we just cannot control, right? I mean, you know, we can't control if the light turns red. You know, I can't control if my boss is an unmanageable person. You know, I can't control my children's happiness. There are many things I cannot control. But that, one reaction to that, seeing that, is then to kind of yield to this sense of helplessness or passivity, which I don't think is actually what's being encouraged, you know. I mean, then you get that sort of attitude, I just have to endure it, you know, or I have to bear it, which I think is not actually what's encouraged. I mean, certainly there are many conditions that we cannot control. The condition of what your mind is doing is one that you certainly are not helpless before. Mm-hmm. You know, am I choosing, is that where I'm choosing to make my home, which is actually, or am I accepting maybe my boss is a bit of a schmuck in this environment, doesn't actually quite know what they're doing. Okay, so what am I doing to make this actually work? You know, do I remember what I love about what I'm doing? Do I actually remember about what's important about what? You know, I see this with, I mean, we all work in systems, don't we? I mean, I work in, systems of meditation centers, praying out loud, you know, which actually, you know, might look from the outside like the most glorious conditions of the world, you know. But you go into any system of meditation centers, you know, you've got politics, you've got people, you've got, you know, all those ingredients, you know. So, you know, am I going to spend my life sort of arguing with all of that? Am I going to do what I can do to actually change the conditions for sure? Am I also going to remember what I love about why I'm doing what I do? You know, what am I highlighting in that situation? But I am actually choosing to stay in, you know, that's only an example. I'm actually choosing to stay in this. I have to remember why I stay, why I love. Change what I cannot change. And to some extent, downsize the difficult?
Stop feeding it.
Yeah, by stop feeding it, you know, you're downsizing the difficult. You know, we're really kind of upsize the difficult by feeding it, you know. And I think that is what creates the amnesia about why am I doing what I'm doing, you know? What is it I love about what I'm doing? Even in this difficult person, you know, is there anything at all that is worth admiring? Because isn't it also true that when someone is really difficult in our life, you know, that we sort of extend that to be the entirety of who they are? And that may not also be so. And actually, when we only ever, I don't know how it is for you, but I know if there's somebody difficult in my life and I only relate to the difficult part of them, that seems to tend, it seems to grow it. You know, if I can actually speak to the part of them that's actually quite lovely, that actually seems to help. You know, but there's so many ways that, you know, this world of conditions is one that we're always juggling in, but too often we're in these kind of oppositional senses that we're either going to overcome it, which gets all the striving and the forcing and the arguing and the battling, or the fear that we're going to be sort of overwhelmed by it, succumb to it. You know, and I think within this world of conditions, there's something else that's being offered in this path, which is not about either overwhelming or being overwhelmed by. You know, it is accepting the limits of our power, and it's also accepting the capacities of our power. You know, I mean, there's many things we bring into that mixture of conditions, including the conditions of mindfulness, including the conditions of investigation, including the conditions of kindness. We're throwing all of that into this mix of conditions, just as we throw our own more difficult mental states into it. Because you know, even if you reflect on that car journey, you know, were there moments when you actually saw the loveliness of the snow on the fields, you know, the light in the trees, or the mind gets so contracted, doesn't it, in that kind of strife.
What you were saying about feeling the discontent, and just that whole car journey was really full of discontent.
Well, sometimes we do it collectively, and that even makes it more juicy. Anyway, I think that's the time for us to just time to pause. So thank you for coming today. Thank you for your practice, being here.
Yes. Thank you. This is wonderful. I feel very content. It is one of my favorite songs. I think I like contentment more than happiness, because happiness sounds like it's too high of a bar for me. But contentment is quite a nice... Anyway, thank you so much for today. I think it was really a rich day, and all of us are going to take on different things. But it's wonderful to have you here. Thank you. Just a few things to say as we wrap up. I mean, that's... First, thank you to all of you for coming. It's wonderful to see all of you here on such a cold day for joining us. Our next retreat is the 15th of January. Is that right, John? We think it's the 15th of January. You'll get an email very soon, actually, because it's not very far away. And that's Martine Batchelor, so I hope to see you.
Yana, sorry.
I haven't done my homework. You can see that. Yanai on the 15th of January. So we hope to see many of you here for that. I'd also like to thank John and Jackie and Anne, and they're all sitting over there, Mabel and Winnie and John and Emery and everybody, and everyone else who helped us with move tables and chairs. We will be having a cup of tea downstairs, and you're all warmly invited to stay and catch up with one another. So please join us downstairs. Could a few people volunteer to come back upstairs at 5 and help me put the room back? Just, I need 3 people. Okay, we should have enough. If anyone else wants to come up, that'd be really appreciated. The last thing is to talk about Dana, which comes at the end, but it's actually one of the most important parts of the day. Many of you know about Dana, but just to remind people, Dana is the word for generosity, and this is a tradition from the time of the Buddha. The idea was that the teachings are seen as priceless. They're offered freely. Christina is here offering the teachings, as people did in the day of the Buddha. And in return for that, we offer support in the way that we can by offering money, by putting money in the back, in the Dana box at the back. And this is really continuing what we see as a very precious tradition of supporting teachers. And it's a very important aspect of Christina being able to come here. All of you paid a little bit of money at the beginning as a registration fee. That money is simply to hire the hall and to pay for travel expenses. None of that money goes directly to Christina. So the money that we put in that box is really her livelihood. She doesn't have a salary from Gaia House or anything like that. So it's her full, you know, it's the way that she earns a living. So I'd ask you all to be as generous as you can in terms of just practically supporting these days, and so that we can continue to have them in Cambridge. So if all of you can make that the next thing you do as we all get up and start wrapping up the day, she has a taxi coming quite soon. So if people can take care of Donna at the end, and please be as generous as you can. Just a couple of other thoughts on Donna. That's the sort of practical basis of the tradition. I think it's a really beautiful tradition and something that we all need to sort of treasure. But I think, you know, quite directly, it's our way of expressing our appreciation to Christina for having come all this way, come from Devon. And the thought and the care and the preparation and also the inspiration that she's provided us with. So I think it's a wonderful way of saying thank you. So that's sort of the first thing. The second thing is more widely, our support of teachers and our support of Christina. All of us have a reasonable standard of living in this country, and I think that our support of teachers means that Christina can go and teach in other places where people's resources and support might be a little bit more limited. So it's a way of making sure that the precious teachings that we all value so much can continue and continue to be taught wherever people want to hear them. And that's the second thing. And the third thing, I think, is just for us to think about it as a way for us to, sometimes we wonder, how do you take your practice off the cushion? I think acts of generosity are one way that we can sort of, it's sort of an invitation for us to explore how we can open our hearts and feel, you know, generosity is a way to feel more connected to others. So it's, you know, there's a chance there to explore how that feels. And I think that's a really important way to think about it. It's the next piece of your practice as you all get up and start backing up. So please be as generous as you can, and thank you all for coming, and we'll see you downstairs.
Does anybody need a lift to the train station? I